So we'll begin our meeting with a reading of the Declaration. The policy of this lodge is independent devotion to the cause of theosophy without professing attachment to any theosophical organization. It is loyal to the great founders of the theosophical movement, but does not concern itself with dissensions or differences of individual opinion. The work it has on hand and the end it keeps in view are too absorbing and too lofty to leave it the time or inclination to take part in side issues. That work and that end is the dissemination of the fundamental principles of the philosophy of theosophy and the exemplification and practice of those principles through a truer realization of the self, a profounder conviction of universal brotherhood. It holds that the unassailable basis for union among theosophists, wherever and however situated, is similarity of aim, purpose, and teaching, and therefore has neither constitution, bylaws, nor officers, the sole bond between the associates being that basis. And it aims to disseminate this idea among theosophists in the furtherance of unity. It regards as theosophists all who are engaged in the true service of humanity without distinction of race, creed, sex, condition, or organization. And it welcomes to its association all those who are in accord with its declared purposes and who desire to fit themselves by studying otherwise to be the better able to help and teach others. The true theosophist belongs to no cult or sect, yet belongs to each and all. In order for this lodge here in Philadelphia, and we are one of many throughout the world, in order for us to accomplish these lofty goals, we have two meetings a week. As now we're here, the doors open at 10:30. The meeting starts at 11 and runs until noon. On Wednesdays, we will continue in our study of the Bhagavad Gita, and the meeting starts at 7:30, goes until 8:30. The library in the front of the building is a reference library. You can prepare and study for the parts that will be studied in class that night. And it opens at 5:15 and closes at 7:15, 15 minutes before the meeting. There is always someone there that can assist you if you want to do any kind of an independent study. You can always get assistance in that. So as we said, on Wednesdays we're studying the Bhagavad Gita. On Sundays, each month has an overall topic. For this month and for September, we will be looking at Aphorisms on Karma by William Q. Judge. And if you need one of the little pamphlets, they are available if you want to have the entire list. We do have a handout each Sunday for the ones we're going to be covering for that particular class. And just a reminder that only on Sundays for the month of August, we will not be having class on Sundays, but we will continue with our Wednesday class. And then September 3rd, we will pick up with the Sunday class in the aphorisms. We have a book table that is open before and after each class that's in the foyer, and you can get any of the straight line theosophical literature, and you only get charged for printing and shipping. The United Lodge of Theosophists is financially sustained entirely by voluntary contributions. Its activities depend similarly on voluntary offerings in time and work. All are invited to participate, but no obligation is imposed or implied. So today we will be looking at aphorisms 11, 12, and 13. And we will have someone, we will have a student who has volunteered to summarize the three of them.
Good morning.
Good morning.
So we're going to take a look at the three aphorisms individually today. And just a brief chat. I'll read each one twice, give a little background or some ideas regarding it. And then when we're finished with all three, we will sit down and there'll be questions and discussion invited by the chair. So the first aphorism is for today's aphorism number 11. Because karma of this earth and its races began in a past too far back for human minds to reach, an inquiry into its beginning is useless and profitless. Because the karma of this earth and its races began in a past too far back for human minds to reach, an inquiry into its beginning is useless and profitless. The first thing that came to mind when we read this is the tendency for the Western mind to only accept, especially when it comes to religion, to only accept as truth what they can prove actually historically happened. And if we can't prove that this happened at such and such a date 2,000 years ago, then it must not be true. The student of theosophy looks at issues like that historically and dismisses the idea that it has to be proven true historically to be relevant. That's completely outside the issue. The issue is the teaching or the story or is the legend or is the myth, is there truth in the idea that's being presented? When or who or where really doesn't matter. It might have happened 1,000 times in history, or it might have happened once. So when we talk about, well, when and how and where, you know, did the absolute beginning of the human mind be, Mr. Judge is saying, stop. Don't waste your time. There are more important things to talk about. Okay, so what could be more important than, the evolution of man and the evolution of the cosmos? Isn't that what the secret doctrine is about? It certainly is. And in this book, which is a biography, a very thorough and respectfully written biography published in recent decades, the last 20 or 30 or so years, we found a very helpful description that addresses this aphorism. And what the author, actually authors, because a lot of students contributed to this biography. What she says is that if we consider the secret doctrine, cosmogenesis, the beginning of the cosmos, and anthropogenesis, the beginning of man, the secret doctrine talks about the beginning and the development of worlds, of universes, of solar systems. In principle, the system, the process that it goes through, in principle. In particular, HPB says what is necessary to know, and what can be known by us is the evolution of this globe that we're on, this globe being one of seven, we're in the fourth of seven globes, the history of this globe in particular, its evolution, the evolution of the lower kingdoms on this globe, and the evolution of those kingdoms and the intelligence that flows through these kingdoms right up to the point when the human form was ready. So, in terms of history and in terms of the volume of information, there's enough there. You know, if you want to go back to, well, where did the human mind come from before Earth? It's not going to happen. But if we start with this globe and the particular evolution of everything on the globe, what we're investigating then is the particular evolution of the very forms that we use, astral, psychic, physical, emotional, intellectual, everything in us is all a part of that. So up to so the first half, cosmogenesis, addresses the evolution up to when the human form was ready to be incarnated. And then anthropogenesis, in terms of historically speaking, that picks up on the history of man from the time that mind incarnated into the physical form, and therefore the physical form became human, and all of the races since then, and our current race now, and even ideas about future races if the plan is followed, and the plan might not be followed. But inquiry into the origin of man is impossible, and that's what the idea is about. That's not to say that there's incredibly interesting, voluminous information that is as deep and broad as you want to go in the secret doctrine. Now, this second aphorism, the title of this book is The Extraordinary Life and Influence, The Extraordinary Life and Influence of Helena Blavatsky, and it's highly recommended. Okay, the second aphorism has what seems to be perhaps a conflict in it. Karmic causes already set in motion must be allowed to sweep on until exhausted. But this permits no man to refuse to help his fellows and every sentient being. Karmic causes already set in motion must be allowed to sweep on until exhausted. But this permits no man to refuse to help his fellows and every sentient being. This idea that karma has to continue, and yet that's not an excuse not to be of service to others who are experiencing challenges, is addressed in this little book, a devotional book written by HPB called The Voice of the Silence. And we would read from it, but just stand here and read it. The words are too small, so we're going to read it from here. That addresses the karma must be allowed to sweep until exhausted, and yet you can't use that as an excuse not to be of service to others who are experiencing challenges in their karma. And in the devotional book, the one is The Path of Renunciation, or also called The Path of Woe. That secret path leads the arhan to mental woe unspeakable, woe for the living dead, and helpless pity for the men of karmic sorrow, the fruit of karma sages dare not still. For it is written, teach to eschew all causes, the ripple of effect as the great tidal wave thou shalt let run its course. And yet, further on, she says, let thy soul lend its ear to every cry of pain, like as the lotus bares its heart to drink the morning sun. Let not the fierce sun dry one tear of pain before thyself hast wiped it from the sufferer's eye. Some people would interpret that as, well, if I wipe the tear from the sufferer's eye, in other words, help that person with their karma, then aren't I interfering with their karma? Aren't I supposed to let the effect of karma just continue on without interfering it? So this might be topic for conversation. And then the third aphorism. The effects, when it comes to karma, cause and effect, the effects may be counteracted or mitigated by the thoughts and acts of oneself or of another. And then the resulting effects represent the combination and the interaction of the whole number of causes involved in producing the effects. So very often we hear, well, for every cause there's an effect, and the effect is commensurate to the cause, and or more or less, can we say, similar to or equal to. It's the, you know, the cause is the seed, the effect is the flower of the seed. Well, what this is saying is, yes, this is true, but when it comes to mitigating or counteracting, very simply, think about if we're at a pool table and we hit the cue ball in a certain direction because of the direction and the force that we sent it in, it's going to go right to the end of the bumper at a very measurable, precise place. But in the middle, before it hit that effect, if we hit it with another ball, it's going to go in a direction, since it was already headed in one direction, it's not going to go in a direction in perfect response to that ball, but it's going to go kind of in the middle because it was already headed this way, it was hitting this direction, so kind of go in the middle. In other words, the direction and the force of the cue ball is mitigated because of another interfering cause. That's a simple way to describe it, but what's the right application? One way that we could think about it is if someone goes into debt, and probably 99% of everybody on planet Earth goes into debt and finds himself at some point in his life unexpectedly some big amount of debt, and that might be $7,000 for one person, or it could be $60,000 in credit card debt for another person. Well, isn't that cause and effect? And we have the karma of that debt. It needs to be paid off. How would we mitigate it? Well, not by not paying it, because you're going to have to pay it. But it could be that the conditions that we found ourselves when we went into debt, if we just make those debt payments, who's to say how the conditions will change? Maybe we'll get a better job. Maybe our business will get better. All a matter of how we think and how we live our life, certain things can change and grow so that that $60,000 debt, which was impossible, seemingly, when we started it, becomes really not a big deal, and we'll be able to wipe that out in about 2 years if conditions change. So we're not being relieved of the karma, right? We still have to pay off the debt, but we're in more of a position, if we live our life in a certain way, to grow in certain ways, to handle that karma and to put it to rest and be done, and then start investing for the future. So this has application, we think, on the moral plane, on the mental plane, in our physical health, and all sorts of things that might be open for discussion.
Thank you.
So we have a lot of food for thought here, and we'll be happy to take any questions or comments in the back.
Number 13, about counteracting or mitigating thoughts and acts of oneself or another, and then the resulting effects represent the combination and interaction of the whole number of causes involved in producing the effects. We're wondering if in the Christian religion, at least, I'm sure in other religions too, that prayer, intercessory prayer, either praying to Jesus or praying to one of the saints, perhaps there's a law behind that, that it's a misapplication of an aphorism, but people really do believe that prayer is powerful, and it actually is. But then, what are we, you know, what does that set up? What does that set up? What if you get your wish, but it's really not pleasing to Rishwara, the higher self?
So the question basically is, how does the idea of prayer pertain to this idea of mitigating karma? And we know that thoughts and feelings are very powerful. And with regular prayer, it's you're asking for the intercession of an outside God, an outside being, to assist you in helping this person get better, say if their friend is sick. But when we look at the idea of prayer theosophically, that person who is asking for those intercessions from an outside deity, at the same time is sending out their own love, their own concern to this person. And we know that we're all connected. You know, that idea of universal brotherhood, that we are all sparks of that deific essence, which connects us all together. So if we are putting out this, I mean, Mr. Judge calls us, says that the human is a dynamo. We have all this energy within us, in our feelings and our thoughts. So if someone is focusing on a sick friend or loved one, not necessarily the prayer itself having any kind of an effect, but just the fact that this love, concern, all these impressions are going out to that person. Yes.
Well, we would think that in all religions, there are those prayers of not asking, but of giving, mm-hmm. of love and devotion, just like the Gita talks about. But, you know, their interpretation may be a little bit different, but the giving is the same.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you wonder why connections in the family, when they're ill, we're aware of it, or we have strong feelings and of just connection.
Mm-hmm.
And that's strong love we have.
Mm-hmm.
And so if we use that as a prayer, then you're really you're putting out something. You're not asking for anything for yourself. You're asking to help. You're asking, you know. I guess it's sort of like, you know, we have to look outside of ourselves,
mm-hmm.
to identify that which is in ourselves. We need that contrast. And if we don't see that connection, that's when we're lost. You know, the connection that I see in you or everybody else that, you know, that exists in each of us. So that's that energy, that connection.
Mm-hmm.
So we counter balance things like that. I think in the Voice of the Silence says that those perfected ones have built a guardian wall. Well, what is this guardian wall? Well, it with their thoughts and deeds of love and compassion.
Mm-hmm.
And that's our only protection, is each other. Now, if we can live for someone else, you know, not, we say that tritely, but I mean in the sense that you're not so selfishly absorbed in your pain, your suffering, your wants, your desires, and it's all about you. And then, you know, it just, you know, that's how you mitigate it. You change how you think.
Mm-hmm.
We just change how we think. I mean, we can't help but do that if we keep on studying, we keep on being devoted, you know, to the truth.
And where when it says in the aphorism, thoughts and acts of oneself or of another. So to continue on this last comment, it is the love and concern, the dedication to others that will mitigate it, not just by us doing it for ourselves, but doing it for others. And as the Gita points out, we have to do it without expecting any type of, you know, thank you in return. We do need to look, we do need to have a goal in mind, of course, but not the kind of reaction of, oh, you're a wonderful person by doing this. And but it is, I mean, love has an enormous potential, enormous energy. And it even, the ocean talks about the love of a mother in Devakan can affect a child here on Earth, because that love, there's that connection. So it can be mitigated. And recently we read something by Rumi where he talks about where to find God. You know, he went to a Christian church, couldn't find God there. Muslim synagogue, couldn't find God there, and then realized that the God was in himself. And that's, we, in regards to prayer, we think that that's where it is, like the prayer coming from that God within. Yes.
Well, we've heard there is no karma unless there is a being to make it and feel its effect. Mm-hmm. So when we look at that first number 11, that stuff is too far back for human minds to reach. It's useless and profitless to go beyond that. So if we begin with number 12, those already set in motion must be allowed to sweep on into exhaustion. And then it says here, let no man to refuse to help his fellows and every sentient being. What is the purpose? Without going further to number 13, there must be a purpose.
Purpose for karma?
Why it, whatever that purpose is, it happens under law.
Mm-hmm.
Cause and effect. So if we understand somehow what the purpose is, perhaps we'll feel better.
Well, the purpose, I mean, when we're looking at the three fundamental principles, the purpose being the third fundamental, that of evolution, we're looking at evolution of soul. And when it talks about an 11, Earth and its races began in a past too far back for human minds to reach. Well, we've always have been and we always will be. But at the same time, progression and perfection continues along. And in regards to number 12 about karmic causes set in motion, we did want to read something, and we put the karma pamphlet out on the desk, and it has a lot of good information. But on page 2, and this is Mr. Judge's article just entitled Karma. Karma, broadly speaking, may be said to be the continuance of the nature of the act, and each act contains within itself the past and the future, which really ties together the aphorisms 11 and 12, because when we're looking at the past, things just, you know, our lives and our reincarnation continues from, we can't even conceive, as it says, are too far back for human minds to reach. But then karmic causes that are already set in motion will continue until the energy that's engendered by the karmic action has been met. So until that, karma has to balance, you know, if you do something wrong, you're going to have to pay for it. You know, the universe needs balance. So as long as that the karmic debt has not been paid, that energy will continue forward. But in the meantime, what you have done in the past is going to continue to come forward into the present life. And then if that lesson hasn't been learned, then that energy will continue in the into the future. So that flow will continue from one life to another. And it's interesting because if it's met in this life, you think you're out of it, something else is going to pop in its place that we're going to have to deal with. And we think the perfect idea is, as was said in the summary about the credit card, you know, the person had this bad karma, you know, set up all this debt, but then it's like almost like they got their stuff together and maybe started helping others, or decided that they were going to stop drinking and, you know, spending, doing all that. So they may have fulfilled a karmic debt, so then some good karma stepped in place. But then we also know of the builder of the Panama Canal. We understand that this gentleman had all this money and invested all this, and then things crashed for him. So you never know. It could go either way, in a positive or a negative direction. But karma has to be served. It's the law. So,
yeah, with that, number 12, must be allowed to sweep until exhausted, but permits no man to refuse to help his fellows. There's the idea of, you know, yes, of course we want to help others, and sometimes helping is not getting involved because they've got their own lessons to learn. You know? So it takes discernment to know the right way to help. And sometimes the best way to help someone is to back off and not get involved because they need to prove themselves. So one analogy that we like to think of when thinking of that is, if we think of someone out swimming on the beach with the big waves and everything, you know, everybody's on body surfing and you take the waves in and you have a great time. And when you're out there, one thing that's kind of interesting with regard to karma is when the waves are forming, you can choose to take that one in and involve yourself in the karma of that wave, or you can just float out there and just kind of let it pass and not get involved with it. You know, depending on how you position your body. And so, you know, you can watch others take the wave in and have a great ride, or you can watch others take the wave in and, like, lose it and go head over heels, which, you know what, maybe they'll do better next time. But the time to get involved is when you see someone else taking the wave and go head over heels and really get hurt. Mm-hmm. So that's an obvious way to discern, but it's a helpful example to try to ask yourself, to get involved with this, is this person really that hurt, and am I the wise enough one to really be able to help him see his way through?
So the idea of interfering with somebody's karma, should we or shouldn't we? And we were always told to err on the side of helping. But we also know that this is a huge, huge question, that whenever we discuss karma in class, it almost always comes up. Is do you or don't you in certain situations? And we certainly can't predict what somebody's karma was. But then we have to look at the idea that, is this our duty that somebody is presenting to us that they need help or suggestions for something in some way? Are we just going to stand by if it's obvious, that's one thing, we can step in. But if it's not so obvious, you know, there's that idea of tough love. So we really can't predict. It's something that one would really have to take into consideration, all the extenuating circumstances, and we still may not know for sure, should we or shouldn't we step in and intercede in a situation. Of course, if it's a safety issue, that's one thing. But if it has something to do with somebody's money issues or whatever, do you let them flounder or do you help? So it is. It's a very, very tough question. Yes?
Well, I think it's obvious that by helping, you become smarter. You either say, well, oops, I shouldn't have done that, or you've seen something that was very beneficial. Mm-hmm. You don't look for the reward, but you have to be aware of it. Because if you do something and you see it just getting worse, then you know that you're not helping. And maybe there's someone else that needs to intercede here or whatever. But that's what life is. It's experimenting and testing and checking how you feel, you know, and what you believe.
And it, you know, your intuition, and especially if you know this person, intuitively you may know, well, you know, if I assist them, you know, he's just going to take it and run. You don't know, right? But like you said, it's, you know, you can help somebody, but then you may learn the lesson, oh, maybe I shouldn't have done that. In the back?
So we need to help, but without enabling. If we're an enabler, we're just helping the person continue. You know, we could have developed quite the dynamic with that person, where for years it might not have been so bad. But all of a sudden, they're, you know, we're going out to get them beer or whatever if they're an alcoholic. And we just, you know, that's enabling. But then there comes a time when you need to speak the truth. And you may alienate that person because they don't want to hear it. They might not hear that I think you really have a problem and you should do something about it. That could be the end of that relationship.
Mm-hmm.
Yet, if you don't speak the truth, you know, it's you're living, it's like a, you're living a lie, in a sense. You just, like, you know, you've got to say, look, the jig is up. You need to look at yourself.
Mm-hmm. Yes, the whole idea of enabling is that that's also a piece that can be looked at into a situation like this. You had your hand up.
Yes. Speaking along the lines of thought here, one simple way of mitigation, I think, would be, for example, if you're walking down the street and you're seeing a person has a homeless sign or whatever, but if you simply use the power of thought to recognize their Buddha nature or their higher self, that alone could help mitigate their state of consciousness. So it's not even mm-hmm. you really have to give something tangible, just to give the thought that you're not who you think you are at the moment. So that would be a very simple, effortless way of mitigating, I would think.
Yeah, karma works on three different planes. Works on the, of course, physical is the one that most of the time people are looking at, but it also works on the emotional and psychic planes as well. So we can affect changes on all three planes. Yes?
There's a word in aphorism 12, but this permits no man to refuse to help his fellows and every sentient being. What's a sentient being?
Well, it's a thinking.
It's a who?
Thinking being, a feeling being, and whenever we think of that, when we're looking at when we're thinking in a theosophical vein, basically everything is conscious to some degree. So when that idea of ascension being, we think pretty much encompasses almost everything or everything, because everything is conscious on some level. We know that most people in the West, when they think of ascension being, they're looking at some don't even think of animals as being sentient. They just think of humans. But theosophically, and if we want to invite some more dialogue on this, everything is conscious to some degree on some level. Is this a follow-up?
Well, we would support you in the spread of those ideas.
Thank you. Enabling me?
Yes, enabling.
Yes. Yeah, well, if we consider the root word of the word sentient is sense. So anything that can sense its external environment, which HPB is very eloquent, even demonstrating that minerals mm-hmm. are sentient.
Yes, thank you. Yes.
We like to use the example of that admiral in the Revolutionary War.
Louder, please.
The one who said, "We have met the enemy and he is ourselves." Well, that fits in perfectly with 12 and 13. In other words, once we understand our relationship with all life, then we begin to act for the benefit of all. And karma, then, is that which reminds us, the fruits of karma, remind us. But I won't do that way, what I'll try over here. But in that process, isn't that also the law of growth?
The law of what?
Growth.
Growth?
Here in this particular case, we become more aware of what our duty is, helping our fellows in every sentient being. We no longer think so selfishly and get slapped on the hand or punched in the jaw. Remind us, aha, I bet the enemy that he's ourselves.
Yes, that idea of, the Gita is a perfect example of that we do fight ourselves, our higher and lower nature. And this is what our progress is based on. It's our evolution. How honorable are we going to be when it comes to this fight? And the whole idea of this sentient being idea and karma, we only would wish that these ideas could be expressed more globally, at least in the West, when it comes to karma, knowing that what we do is going to have ramifications for us in the future. And how we treat the lower kingdoms will also impact on how our reincarnation will be in the future. So these ideas are... And we have to support each other in putting these ideas out and helping and discussing with others. If we see, if we're in a conversation and something opens up and we think that, maybe we can slip in a theosophical idea, we're hoping that things can improve in the world. Yes.
I read something really beautiful recently, and I kind of hope it sort of correlates to this. It's everything is in a sheet of paper. Like, everything is within everything. Like, in a sheet of paper, you not only have the logger who cut the tree down, the sun, the rain, the dirt, the soil, everything is within that sheet of paper. The ideas of the person that wrote on that sheet of paper. So it's really that, like, in a karmic kind of thing, it's everything is so interrelated mm-hmm. and interconnected. And, you know, the actions that you have towards someone, whether it's action or inaction, it is going to have some kind of effect. And hopefully you're dealing with the higher aspect of yourself in order to have a more harmonious kind of karma.
Well, the idea of everything being in a slice of in a piece of paper, when one can definitely look back and see where that paper came, and it theosophy also, and we think it was HPB, spoke about how we impress everything with our thoughts and our feelings, and how even preparing food can be done in a loving, spiritual way, that by, if we're, you know, if we're preparing something and we're angry and it's like, oh, he shouldn't have said this, and, you know, I'll show him, that those negative feelings can be transmitted to the food. And that if we're making a salad, just looking at, you know, the person who planted it, who watered it, who picked it. And we know the whole idea with the migrant workers, you know, that sending good thoughts out to this person who picked it because they have a very hard life. And so, and bringing it back and preparing it in a loving way and knowing that these things are healthy for our family, for our loved ones, our friends. So we, again, we are dynamos and we can affect everything. Yes.
We think the first step or the first rule is do unto others as you would have them do unto you, for it shall be done unto you as well.
Mm-hmm.
So that last part is usually not included, but that's the law. That's the law of cause and effect. So if I know as a child we always kept that in mind, even though we had a lot of questions about everything, but we always tried. Our mother used to beat it into us.
Whatever worked.
Yeah, well, I don't know. Nothing really worked at that time.
Thank you. Yes.
Well, I guess there's you know, two sides to every coin, and we were thinking this bit about mitigation of karma. Well, if we tell a lie, and we see what the effects of that lie might be, we think that, well, we can mitigate that by lying about something, and then lie about that.
Right.
Keep a track of all the lies so that nothing actually comes back. And but eventually what goes around comes around.
Right.
So it's easier just to tell the truth because you don't have to remember how many lies that you told to try to
right, that,
manage
the,
this construct.
The whole idea with telling lie upon lie gets tiring because you have to remember, oh no, what did I just say? But we did want to, in regards to 12, in that same article by Mr. Judge on page 3, it's something that, in regards to desire, where is it? Oh, we can't find it. Oh. Their courses ended when there is no longer a basis or suitable medium in which they can adhere. They expend their force and are not anymore. Karma is therefore as dependent upon the present personality for its fulfillment as it was upon the former for the first initiation of that act. So desire brings forward this whole idea of a continuance of the karma on how we act. And in to follow up on the idea of telling a lie, if your desire is to not get caught about something, or that you don't want to face somebody with an unhappy experience or whatever, that desire to look right in somebody's eyes can make this karmic lesson continue on and on until at some point in a future life, that desire has kind of worn itself out, and we finally will end that energy that is perpetuating that one bit of karma. Yes.
Modern psychiatry and psychology has done wonderful work since the invention of certain techniques and certain drugs and so forth. And those that have benefited often say, well, I have to depend on my doctor so much until they hear of the term independent devotion. And they get those three fundamental ideas, and they're on their own. That independence, that acceptance of conditions and circumstances, and the ability to say, I can do. And then they learn the moral purpose of life.
Mm-hmm.
They understand the third fundamental. And then they understand, well, I mean, I'm no different than anyone else. I have to help. And that way, they have regained their independence. And whether they get slapped in the face of the moral trouble, they might be
Well, independence, that's how we learn, by doing it our way. And the whole idea of growth is, if it doesn't work, to take a step back and say, well, how could I do that better? And we know in the philosophy, independent devotion to the cause. And we often wonder, because we have to work when we come here. We're the ones that have to study. We're the ones that have to ask questions. We have to learn how to meditate. There's a lot of things that independently we have to do. Of course, there are older, more experienced students that we can ask for help and assistance and clarification. But when it comes down to it, when we walk out the door, it's on us to do it ourselves. So we have to learn. We have to use our intuition. And what happens, we have to look back and think, well, we have to do something different. What is it? There's a cute little saying that the idea, we can't remember it. Maybe it'll pop up into our heads. Yes?
Well, if we look back, we're really the same person we've always been. The only thing that's changed is our ideas.
Mm-hmm.
Just a few of the ideas that we've always held, and like, we don't think that way anymore. We think, you know, and everything changes just with a little of looking at life through karma and reincarnation, you know, and the Gita. I mean, it all becomes very plain,
mm-hmm.
how we should act, you know. But we have that guidance,
yes.
Even though we don't act that way all the time, you know. But we're allowed to be human, and that's how we learn.
Mm-hmm.
You know, our lower nature has been in control for we don't know how long, how many generations. But now, in this incarnation, you know, we have become aware of Krishna, our higher nature,
mm-hmm.
and we realize that there's something about us that's eternal. And that's ever the witness to the changing panorama of life.
And knowing that about ourselves, we also have to take that a step forward, that everybody is Krishna. We all have our higher nature, and we all have to be aware that our neighbor, that person sitting next to us on the trolley, that no matter how they're acting, they are going through their karmic lessons as well. And we did just remember what it was we wanted to say. It was mental illness is doing the same thing over and over again and expecting the same result. A different result. And doing the same thing over and over again and expecting different results. We have to change, as was said. And we are our higher nature, the I, that stays the same throughout all incarnations. What is different is our personalities. And even in one life, we always have that same sense of I. But as was said, it's our ideas that we hold. It's the actions that we perform that can change and make our lives and the people we come in contact with better. And we've all known people who, just by saying hello to them, they just radiate goodness and love and can affect with really not even saying much to people. So, you know, it's like an idea that we can keep in mind, that to smile at people and say hi. And it's amazing, you know, waiting in the checkout line, going up to a cashier who's been on her feet all day, just to say hi, you know, how are things going? Are you almost done work? And, you know, have a good evening, whatnot, just a little kindness. Yeah.
That all comes from inside of us, from the ideas that we hold to be true, that we see ourselves as a part of everyone else. And that's where we shouldn't aim to change anything about ourselves, except the ideas that we hold to be true.
Mm-hmm.
And once we are confirmed in our beliefs, our life changes from within outward. So we're concerned so much for the outward shell and the material effects, but they will change. Just work on the inside. And you will see that you will want to work on the outside. But it comes from within outward.
And that whole idea of working on the inside is our independent devotion to the cause. So we are done for today, and our meeting is open.
No,